So have you got dreams? Got hopes? Got plans? You know, you don't have to be very old for those plans to change. You know, usually by the time you're even 20 or whatever, you've changed majors, you've changed jobs, you know, whatever. Certainly by the time you get to my age, there have been a few twists and turns that you didn't expect, and you realize if you look back and think about what you were hoping or dreaming 20, 30, 40 years ago, you think, oh, my goodness, that's not what I planned. And then where do you land with that? Are you disappointed? Are you kind of resentful and mad that stuff just didn't turn out quite like I thought it would? Or do you look back and you think, well, yeah, it wasn't what I planned, but, you know, I can see God's hand in it. Well, today's story about Joseph is kind of one of those stories. His life was not what he thought it was going to be. So last week, we learned about how God told Abraham and Sarah to go and to be a blessing, and they went and they blessed. And their obedience in following and trusting God really turned into a huge vehicle for God's blessing, actually, to the whole world. And most of it, long after they were dead and gone, they really never got to see God's promises to them fulfilled, most of them anyway. They didn't get to see very much of this nation that God promised that he would build from their family. And they didn't get to see the one descendant of this family who would ultimately be born, Jesus, who would ultimately be a blessing and a savior to the whole world. But they did see what God called them to do, and they did do it, albeit with a few stumbles, and they trusted that God would do what he promised he would do. So this week is about Joseph, and Joseph was actually Abraham and Sarah's great-grandson. Their son's name was Isaac, and then Isaac had Esau and Jacob, and Joseph is Jacob's son, right? So he's their great-grandchild. And most people have heard at least part of the story, even if it's just from seeing Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. Remember that musical? It was one of Andrew Lloyd Webber's first from the 1970s. There's some very funny YouTube videos if you want to look back. It's not at all dated. So many of you probably read the story in chapter 3 this week. And if the story of Abraham and Sarah showed us that nobody's too old to have a significant role in the story, then Joseph's story shows us, among other things, that you're also never too young to have a significant role in God's story. And one thing that's similar between last week's story and this week's story is that God was really in charge of the timeline and everything that happened. In the short term, it really didn't look like God was following through on the details or bringing about any good purpose in Joseph's life, or in Abraham and Sarah's for that matter. But as the characters held on to hope and they trusted God's faithfulness, they did see his plan start to unfold. And this is one of those stories that we have to really remember as we read it. You know, we get the benefit of sitting down and reading the story all at once, all in one go. So you can turn the page and see what happened next in 2 years, in 5 years, in 10 years, in 17 years. And you can capture it all. You know, if you read the chapter, you could sit down and read it in one sitting. But we have to think about all the time that went by. Joseph was only 17 when his troubles began. And those troubles continued for 22 years. So he didn't get to turn the page and see the happy ending that was going to come. He didn't even know if there would be a happy ending. So it's really valuable to look at Joseph and how he handled that and what he did through all those years of struggle with no certain outcome at the end. And perhaps more than any other story in the Bible, Joseph's life is just a great example of how what's happening in the daily reality of that lower story isn't necessarily reflecting what God's doing in his big eternal upper story. Joseph rides this roller coaster through his life of good times and bad times and kind of mediocre times, really bad times, back up to good times, you know? And it looks like God's gone AWOL, or he certainly doesn't care about the fact that he's suffering, and very unjustly most of the time. But Joseph doesn't waver in his commitment to God and entrusting his life to him. And in the end, he looks back and he can see how God had a bigger purpose, and his decades of affliction were part of something much bigger and definitely worthwhile. So what we're going to do is we're going to walk through the lower story of Joseph's life. And we're going to look at the highs and lows, and we're going to kind of do a how was it going at this point meter. You know, was it a low point, a high point? How was that going? So we'll walk through the lower story, and then we'll come back and we'll look at it for from the upper story perspective of what was going on. So actually, pretty much the last quarter of the book of Genesis is devoted to the story of Joseph. It's a long story. There's a lot to it. So we start out in chapter 37 of Genesis, and we hear that Joseph was Jacob's favorite son. And it tells us it was because he was a son of his old age. He was born later on. He was a favorite. But also, he was the first son of Jacob's favorite wife. Do you remember? Jacob worked for 7 years, and he got married off. You know, he finds out the woman under the veil wasn't Rachel, who he thought he was going to marry. He was stuck with Leah, her older sister, who wasn't nearly as pretty. But she did have children, more children than Rachel, so she had got that going for her. But anyway, so then he had to work another 7 years to get the woman he really wanted that was Rachel. So, and it was a long time then before Rachel had children. So when Joseph finally arrived, son of his favorite wife, so he's a favorite. And so Jacob gave him this robe. And, you know, what do we know about this robe? Many colors. Actually, do you know the one thing we think we really know about Joseph? It's a little, we're not quite sure on the translation. It might just mean a robe with long sleeves. Isn't that disappointing? All that stuff we thought we knew, that Joseph had a robe of many colors. We learned that in Sunday school. It might just be a robe with long sleeves. But anyway, robes were kind of a big deal back then. You know, you gave robes as a sign of, you know, it was sort of a sign of, oh, the family robe, you know. That was a big deal. So giving that to Joseph, one of his youngest sons, it made his brothers really mad. So you've got this huge rivalry going on in the family, and Joseph, everybody's jealous of Joseph, all his brothers. He's got 11 brothers, and they basically all hate him. And it actually tells us in the Bible that they are so angry and eaten up with their hurt that they couldn't even speak peacefully to him. So then Joseph starts having dreams, and he has this dream where he's a sheaf of wheat, and his brothers are 11 sheaves of wheat, and they bow down to him. Now, he told his brothers about this dream, which, you know, if you've got brothers who are jealous of you, that's probably not the smartest move on the planet. But anyway, that's what he did. And, of course, they hate him all the more. And then he has another dream where the sun and moon are bowing down to him. And he tells them about that. And it's like, Joseph, get a clue. You know, it's just making things worse. So, anyway, how are things going at this point? Well, okay, so he's his dad's favorite son. So, you know, he's got that going for him. But he's hated by his brothers, which is not good. There's no peace in the family. So it's not exactly a happy family situation. So then his family is herdsmen. They've got sheep, they've got goats, they've got flocks. So his brothers are all out in the countryside taking care of the flocks. And Joseph is sent out by his dad to see how they're doing. And they see Joseph coming. They think, this is our chance. We can finally get rid of this irritating little upstart who's so full of himself, and he's dad's favorite, and then maybe we'll get a little bit of the love, right? So they decide that they're going to murder him, but Reuben, one of his brothers who has a little bit of a conscience, says, why don't we just throw him in a pit? And he's secretly thinking, I'll go rescue him later. But this evolves into they sell him to a bunch of Ishmaelites. And, you know, I hadn't thought about that until I read the story this week, but think, Ishmaelites. Who was Ishmael? Remember? That was that son that Abraham had with his slave girl Hagar when he and Sarah are trying to give God's plan to build a nation a little help. So it's interesting because actually these were his second cousins that he was sold to. It doesn't mention that they're family in any way, so there's obviously a pretty huge divide between the Ishmaelites and the descendants of Isaac. But anyway, that's just kind of an aside. So he's sold to these Ishmaelites, and they deceive Jacob into thinking that David's dead, that Joseph is dead. We haven't got to David yet. That's a few weeks yet. That Joseph is dead. They put some animal blood on his robe, and Jacob is just devastated, and he just mourns, and his life, you know, he's just overwhelmed by Joseph's apparent death. And Joseph is sold to Potiphar in Egypt, and Potiphar is one of the officers of Pharaoh. He's the captain of the guard. So how are things going now? Well, not good, right? Well, at least he wasn't murdered, but he was sold as a slave to foreigners, and his dad thinks he's dead. He doesn't have a cell phone. He's got no legal system. He's got no international human rights organizations to go rescue him. So really, it would look pretty hopeless, right? I mean, this would be pretty devastating for a 17-year-old. So I think we'd call this a low, right? On our how's it going meter. But it does say in chapter 39, verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man. So even as a slave in Potiphar's house, he has success and favor, and he gets promoted to overseer of the whole house. He's in charge of everything, and the Lord blessed Potiphar's house just because Joseph was there, which is really cool. So how are things going now? Well, they're going well because, you know, this stopped working. Okay, all right. So he's still a slave, but he's got responsibility, he's got success, and at least now he's getting a little respect, huh? So that, you know, that's kind of good. Well, then, little twist in the plot, Potiphar's wife gets the hots for him, because it does actually tell us in the Bible that he was handsome and well-built. So calm down, ladies. But anyway, he's not having any of it, though. He's like, no, I'm not having any of that wickedness. I mean, this is pretty good, because he's a young man, right? He's all by himself, but it's pretty amazing. He's just like, no, I'm not even going to listen to you. I'm not going to be in the same room as you. No, I'm not going to do that to my master. He trusts me. I'm not going to betray him, and I'm not going to do anything so bad. Well, she's mad. She's a bit of a desperate housewife. She's used to getting her own way, and she does not like this. So she wrongly accuses him of raping her, and so he ends up just thrown in jail. His master's like, oh, do this thing. I trusted you. And there he is in jail. Egyptian prisons were not known for being comfortable. You didn't get to work on a degree in your spare time. This was not, you know. So how are things going? Well, this is a pretty deep dip in the roller coaster here. It's unjust. It's undeserved. It's unpleasant. He's got absolutely no recourse, no resources, no advocates to help get him out of this jail. But again, later in chapter 39, we read, the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. So how are things going? Well, a little better. You know, even in prison, he's given favor, he's given responsibility, he's successful, and even in prison, he has some respect. Then in chapter 40, we get this ray of hope. So there's the chief cupbearer and the chief baker have also been imprisoned, and they both have dreams. And Joseph correctly interprets these dreams that one of them is going to be reinstated to his position, and one of them is going to be put to death, and they come true. And so what's really cool is Joseph apparently has learned a little humility, but he certainly knows when to give credit to God, because when they have dreams, he just has this great confidence. He says, well, yeah, God can interpret dreams, and he just fully expects that God will give him the correct interpretation of the dreams, and he does. And he does take the opportunity to maybe this will be a chance for me to get some justice. So he says to the cupbearer, he says, only remember me when it is well with you, and please do me the kindness to mention me to Pharaoh, and so get me out of this house. For I was indeed stolen out of the land of the Hebrews, and here also I have done nothing that they should put me into the pit. But the cupbearer promptly forgot him. He gets his old job back, but he forgets about Joseph. So how are things going? Nowhere. Absolutely nowhere. His big hope of someone putting in a good word for him fades to nothing, right? 2 years later, 700 days later in an Egyptian prison, Pharaoh has a dream. Now, if you've seen the musical, this is where Pharaoh impersonates Elvis and breaks into song. Look up Pharaoh's Dream on YouTube. It is very funny. So the cupbearer remembers him. He says, oh, Pharaoh, you had a dream. No one can interpret it. And it was obviously really disturbing Pharaoh. He says, oh, there was this guy in prison. He told me what my dream meant, and it came true. And he told the baker what his dream meant, and that came true too. He's not here to tell you about it because it came true. So Pharaoh says, great, we'll go get Joseph. So Joseph comes, and Pharaoh said to Joseph, this is what it says in Genesis 41:15, Pharaoh said to Joseph, I have had a dream, and there's no one who can interpret it. I've heard it said that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. Joseph answered Pharaoh, it's not me. God will give Pharaoh a favorable answer. So it's cool. He gives the credit to God that he's the one who's going to give him the answer. So Joseph tells Pharaoh, he interprets the dream for him, that there's going to be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of famine. And he tells him to find someone discerning and wise who will take a fifth of all the produce in the good years and set it aside to store up for the famine. And what's interesting here is Pharaoh acknowledges that the Spirit of God is on Joseph. It says, and Pharaoh said to his servants, can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only as regards the throne will I be greater than you. So he puts him as second in command. And it's amazing that he does this before a single word of the dream interpretation has come true. Right? So God's spirit must somehow have, it says Pharaoh recognized his spirit on Joseph, but somehow this rung true with Pharaoh, and he trusted the interpretation, and he trusted that this was going to happen. So he gives Joseph his signet ring. He's basically giving Joseph a rubber stamp on any laws he wants to pass. He gives him fine linen garments, a gold chain, and that was even before the 1970s version of the musical. He gives him his second chariot. He tells everyone they have to pay homage to him. He's given authority. He's given a wife. And if I was Joseph, I'd be sweating a little. I'd be thinking, oh, God, this better be right. I'm in trouble if it's not, right? So I think I'd be a little bit scared. You know, he's still only 30 at this point, and he's had 13 years of since being sold into slavery at age 17. So, but how are things going? Well, they're going really well, right? In a day, he goes from being in an Egyptian prison to being second in command of the whole nation. It's like, whoa. And even Pharaoh recognizes that God's spirit's with him. So it's kind of like the roller coaster becomes one of those rapid elevators, you know, the ones that sort of leave your stomach at the bottom when they go to the top. And he's like, whoa, you know, sudden rise to success. So it does come true. The dream interpretation was correct, and there's 7 years of all these bumper crops, and Joseph gathers the extra food. Meanwhile, he also has two sons. And then the famine starts. So there's famine in Egypt and all the surrounding nations, and everyone starts going to Joseph for grain. Well, how are things going? Well, they're going very well, right? The interpretation that God gave him was right on. He's been able to set up systems for food storage and food distribution. And he's made Pharaoh very rich because people come and buy grain, and they end up eventually selling themselves to Pharaoh and when they run out of money. So Pharaoh's gaining wealth, he's gaining control, and he is very happy with Joseph. So this is a definite high point for Joseph. Well then, meanwhile, back in Canaan, the people are getting hungry. So Jacob, his father, sends Jacob's sons to Egypt to buy grain because he hears, oh, there's grain in Egypt. Well, okay, you better go. But he doesn't send Benjamin, Joseph's younger brother, because he's the other brother, other son of the favorite wife. And he's like, I've lost Joseph. Not going to lose Benjamin too. Benjamin can stay here. The rest of you can go and get grain. So the brothers bow down to Joseph. Wow. Does that sound like a dream he had a long, long time ago? And he pretends not to recognize them. He accuses them of being spies. He sticks them in prison for 3 days, and he tells them, I'll keep Simeon, and he's staying here in prison. You can all come, but if you come back, you better bring that younger brother of yours with you. So they return to Jacob, and they're horrified to find that the money they'd paid for the grain has been put back in their sacks. They're kind of afraid of what's going on here. They've had to leave Simeon there. They can't go back without Benjamin. And Jacob refuses to let Benjamin go. So they're pretty afraid. So how are things going here? Well, finally, Joseph's earlier dreams have come true, right? 22 years later, and you can kind of feel the tension, can't you? Joseph's making his brothers sweat a little bit. So is he going to stick it to them? Is he going to get revenge? Or is he going to be kind to them? We really don't know at this point, right? We get a little hint to his soft heart because he has to leave the room to weep when he sees them, but we still don't really know how this is going to go. Joseph is still separated from his family, from his family, and they seem to just leave Simeon in the jail there to rot. You know, it's quite a while goes by before they come back again. So he doesn't really know where their hearts are at either. The famine is very severe, and it continues. So eventually Jacob sends his brothers back with all kinds of gifts, and they can't grow grain, but apparently they've still got pistachio nuts and a few other delicacies. So they send him back with that, and he does eventually agree to let Benjamin go because they say, well, that's the only way we can see him again. He won't give us any more food unless we take Benjamin. So Judah, the oldest, he pledges his safety. He says, Dad, I'll take care of Benjamin. I promise he'll come back. So the brothers show up, and they immediately say to the doorman, look, our money was given back to us last time. So it's like, oh, okay, well, they've learned a little honesty there. The doorman says, no, I didn't give your money back to you. So anyway, they bow to Joseph, they give him the presents, and, you know, here they are bowing to Joseph again. Joseph orders a big feast, and Joseph has to leave to weep because he's just so overcome with emotion. And once again, he sends them back with food, plus he puts the money that they'd paid for the food again back in their sacks. But he also has the servants plant his silver cup in Benjamin's sack. He basically sort of frames Benjamin as having stolen it. And when Joseph's servants run after them and find the cup in Benjamin's sack, Benjamin's going to be punished by death. But Judah, who has pledged his life for Benjamin, says, please, you know, replace Benjamin with me. I'll die for him, because otherwise our father's just going to die of grief. So how are things going? Well, you know what? Joseph is totally in control here. He's got the upper hand, doesn't he, with his brothers. He's got the power to get revenge or the powers to bless them. They are absolutely at his mercy. Well, at this point, Joseph pretty much loses control. So he sends all the Egyptians away out of the room, and he privately reveals who he is to his brothers. And there is just tons of weeping. It's a very emotional moment for the whole family as they're reunited. And it really is awesome what he says. This really reveals Joseph's heart. In chapter 45, verses 5 through 7, he says, and now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. And we all heave this huge sigh of relief at Joseph's forgiveness and mercy. So he instructs them to bring Jacob and all the people and his possessions, and Pharaoh even gives a blessing for his whole family to come and live in Goshen, this area in Egypt. And it's kind of a cute moment where he says to them, yeah, and when you go, don't quarrel on the way. It's like, I guess they're still brothers. It takes Jacob a while for them to believe the brothers that he's alive, and he just it just seems too good to be true. I mean, it's been 22 years. He really thought Joseph was gone. So to hear that his son is alive. But eventually Israel, Joseph's now called Israel, and the whole family, 70 people, they pack up all their possessions, their flocks. They go to Egypt to settle there, and Joseph and Jacob are reunited. So how are things going? Well, really well. Joseph's dreams have come true. He's reconciled with his family in a way that he would never have thought possible, and he never could have brought about by himself. And he's ridden this roller coaster of ups and downs for 22 years, even without knowing that his family would eventually come back together. And he's been trusting God without knowing what the outcome would be. His forgiveness of his brothers allows for reconciliation and a reuniting of the family. And he allows for provision for food so that this nation that God had created didn't starve to death before it even got formed. And it's just amazing, isn't it, how he can recognize that there's more to the story than his unfair treatment. When you think of everything that he's gone through, he's got a great case for resentment and bitterness and a self-focus, and he doesn't have any of that. He says, you thought you sent me here. No, God sent me here. That this was for a much bigger purpose. It's a very different focus that he had. And there's this happy ending. Got 22 years of hardship, followed by, from here on, he had 71 years of peace and prosperity with his family. He died at 110, the Bible tells us. The story isn't quite over. Jacob dies, and the brothers go to Joseph, and they pretend that their father had made this plea for Joseph to forgive them, because they're a little afraid. Well, now that dad's dead, he might take this moment to get revenge for everything that we did. And Joseph just weeps when they say this to him. And they fall down before him and they say, we're going to be your servants. And he says to them, this is another one of those amazing things that Joseph says, do not fear, for do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring about that many people should be kept alive. So he spoke kindly to them. So how are things going? Well, isn't it sad that the brothers are still living with shame and fear because of their sin? And we don't know, does Joseph weep because of his father's request? It's kind of an emotional thing if he believes it came from him. Or does he weep because his brothers are still lying if he knows that his father didn't really say that? Or does he weep because they're still living in shame and it breaks his heart to see that? Or just because of his desire for there to be full trust between him and his brothers? We don't know. Just see Joseph's tender heart. So at the end of the story, we'd all agree, wouldn't we, that Joseph got to play a major role in God's story. And because of his character, because of his attitude and his outlook on life, he was perfectly cast to play this important role in God's story. And we can read the story in its entirety in just absolute awe, and we can see how God used every twist and turn of it, even his brother's sin and betrayal, to accomplish his good purposes. Joseph never faltered. He was always true and faithful to God's call on his life in every situation, whether he was head of a military household, in charge of other prisoners, or second in command only to Pharaoh. And in spite of every negative circumstance, his separation from a family, being sold as a slave, being wrongly accused, being in prison all the length of the timeline, he didn't know the final outcome of the lower story, but he trusted God and he remained faithful and he always credited God for his success. So we look at the lower story. We see a godly man. We see one who survived adversity. He held on to hope. He remained faithful. He rode the roller coaster. He experienced God's favor along the way, which eventually extended to everyone that he met, that he served, everyone that he led. And ultimately, he saw God come through for him and his family in a really amazing way, right? So that's the lower story. And we see the roller coaster. We see how it turned out. But what's the upper story? What was God up to in all of this? We've had a few clues as we go along. But there's two places where the Bible gives us some perspective on what God was doing in the upper story in Jesus' life. One of them's in the New Testament. And, you know, it's really awesome when the New Testament looks back at Old Testament stories. Last week, Hebrews 11 and Romans gave us a little bit of perspective on Abraham. But, you know, when these New Testament writers look back, they're inspired by the Spirit. And they can see the bigger picture, and they can give us a little bit of commentary as they look back. They, for one thing, can see how everything was pointing to Jesus coming. So they've got a whole different perspective on what was going on. And there's a couple verses in Acts chapter 7. This is a speech that Stephen gave. This is after Jesus died, was resurrected, went to heaven. The early church is starting to form. And Stephen gives this testimony about what God was doing in a speech. He's actually, the religious leaders are really mad at this new religion that's come around, that's kind of shaking up the status quo and threatening their power in the system. And Stephen ends up being stoned to death after he makes this speech. But he has amazing insight as he looks back over what God was doing in the Old Testament. So this is what he says about Joseph. This is Acts chapter 7, verses 9 and 10. Says, and the patriarchs were Joseph's brothers. Remember the 12 tribes of Israel? Those 12 brothers were the head of the 12 tribes of Israel. So those are the patriarchs. And the patriarchs, jealous of Joseph, sold him into Egypt, but God was with him and rescued him out of all his afflictions and gave him favor and wisdom before Pharaoh, king of Egypt, who made him ruler over Egypt and over all his household. There's four principles there in God's upper story that apply to Joseph's life and they apply to our life. God was with him, and God is with us. God rescued him. God rescues us. God gave him favor. God gives us favor. And God gave him wisdom. God gives us wisdom. So we're going to look at those a little bit. God was with Joseph. God was working in and through all the circumstances of Joseph's life, every hardship, every disappointment, every honor, every success, every pitch up and down of the roller coaster. And he was working in and through his character. Every choice to honor God and honor his masters, every time he gave God credit for his abilities, his genuine forgiveness of his brothers, all those things in his character, God was with him in every circumstance and every choice that he made. God hadn't abandoned him, even if it looked like it in that particular moment. God was there helping him, protecting him, orchestrating events towards divine conclusions. And Joseph remained faithful, and he chose to believe that God was with him, even when his faithfulness to God was challenged in some really extreme ways. God's with us, not just in a warm, fuzzy, oh, I'll hold your hand, I'll cry when you cry, and I'll laugh when you laugh, and oh, I just love you, and I'm with you. It's not just that. He's with you. He's with your story. Your story is part of his story. He cast you in your role, and he's the ultimate director, coaching you through it. Matthew 28:20, Jesus is leaving. He's leaving physically the earth. This is after his death, after his resurrection. He's going back to heaven to be with his Father. And he says to his disciples, and behold, I am with you always to the end of the age. I'm with you. That's his promise. Of course, he's not going to be with them physically, but he reassures them that his presence is going to remain with them through his Spirit. And then in John 14, another gospel writer captures what Jesus says about being with us. John 14:16-17. Jesus says, as he's leaving again, he says, I will ask the Father. And he will give you another helper to be with you forever. Even the Spirit of truth, whom the world cannot receive, because it neither sees him nor knows him, you know him, for he dwells with you and will be in you. God's Spirit is with us. He's so with us that he's actually in us, inside us. He's helping us. He's guiding us. He's empowering us from inside. Whatever ups and downs you go through in life, God is with you. Jesus is with you. He's right there by his Spirit. You're not alone. He's not absent. He's involved. If you're following him, whether it looks like it or not, whether you see him there or not, whether you feel him or not, he's right there with you and in you. So God is with us. God also rescued Joseph, right? Several points in the story you could look at and say, God was not rescuing Joseph at that moment. When he's in the prison for years and years and years, it really doesn't look like God is rescuing. But in the big picture, you can see that he not only rescued Joseph, he rescued the whole nation through Joseph, and actually even the surrounding nations. He rescued his life. He wasn't murdered. He was sold as a slave, but he wasn't murdered. There's still hope while you're still breathing. He rescued his reputation. When he was falsely accused, he ended up again being given responsibility in positions of power and trust. And he rescued his family relationships through Joseph's forgiveness and through the reconciliation. And God rescues us too. Now, again, it doesn't always look like if you take a snapshot of any moment in time, it doesn't necessarily look like God is rescuing us. That moment when you lose your job, or when you have health problems, or when you're struggling in relationships, or you feel like you've been betrayed or unjustly treated, or you just feel like everything you touch fails, it doesn't necessarily feel like God's rescuing us. But God's rescue is bigger than that, and it's more important than those individual circumstances. In 2 Timothy 4:17-18, this is Paul speaking. He wrote this letter to Timothy when he was actually in jail, and he was awaiting execution because of his faith. That doesn't exactly look like rescue, does it? This is what he says. But the Lord stood by me and strengthened me, so that through me the message might be fully proclaimed and all the Gentiles might hear it. So I was rescued from the lion's mouth. And it's probably not a literal lion. It's probably just meaning a fierce enemy. I was rescued from the lion's mouth. The Lord will rescue me from every evil deed and bring me safely into his heavenly kingdom. To him be the glory forever and ever. Amen. See, Paul has confidence that God's rescued him many, many times and will rescue him ultimately from death. Even if he's executed, God will still bring him into his heavenly kingdom. And he's convinced that that eternal rescue is better than any rescue from prison or hardship now. Knowing that rescue is certain in our lives, well, for Paul, it gave him the courage to face all kinds of hardship that he faced. And the certainty that God will rescue us also gives us courage to face whatever we have to deal with when life's difficult. So Joseph was rescued, we are rescued. God gave Joseph favor. Did you notice that everywhere Joseph went, the story tells us he had favor with people of influence? He was Jacob's favorite son. Potiphar put him in charge of his entire household. Even in the prison, the jailer puts him in charge of everything that happens in the prison and all the other prisoners. And then he ends up being second only to Pharaoh, in charge of the whole nation. That's amazing favor, right? It wasn't favor that he brought on himself. I mean, you know, sure, he had good character. He proved himself trustworthy and capable. But there's a lot of stuff here that's completely out of his control, that could only be attributed to God's goodness towards him. It was God who gave him favor. And God gives us favor. In Luke chapter 4, verses 18 and 19, Jesus is quoting Isaiah here. And he says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives." That's actually talking about rescue right there. "And recovering sight to the blind, and to set at liberty those who are oppressed," more rescue, "to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." See, God had promised through the prophet Isaiah that there was going to be a time that would come that people who were living in relationship with him would experience his favor. So Jesus is quoting that in Luke, and he's saying, hey guys, that thing that Isaiah was talking about, that time is now. This has come now. You have God's favor. God's favor is here. If we choose to repent of our sins, if we choose to trust and follow God, we have his favor. We get to live in relationship with God. We get to do life with his Spirit. And if that's not favor, what is? That's the best kind of favor. And we can expect God's favor in our lives now, not just an eternity after we die. This isn't the kind of favor that makes everything easy and rosy and whatever, but it's the kind of favor where God surprises us. He makes connections that we could never have made, or he gives us influence, or people we come into contact with are blessed because they know us and because of us in their lives, because we have God's favor that we can share with them. You know, just a little silly example right now is New Crossing Church has favor with the Sun Prairie Star. The marketing consultant who's in charge of the advertising is a Christian, and she's really interested in getting papers good rates and helping us design eye-catching ads. That's favor. That's God's favor. That's just one little example that's come up in the last couple of weeks. So where's God given you favor? Where's he given you influence or opportunities or blessings? If we don't expect it, we may not even notice it. But this is the year of the Lord's favor. Let's expect it. Let's look for it. Let's notice God's favor and give him credit for that favor in our lives. So God gave Joseph wisdom, right? God gave Joseph incredible wisdom. And not necessarily in telling his family his dreams when he was a teenager. That really wasn't the best wisdom. But he learned. He certainly had wisdom in running Potiphar's household, in staying righteous, organizing a prison, administering famine prevention programs, and God gave him strategy, amazing strategy, just incredible wisdom. God blessed him, and he blessed everyone connected with him because of the wise way that he conducted his life and exercised his leadership. and God gives us wisdom. There's a great little verse in James. James chapter 1, verse 5. It says, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given to him. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't always feel that wise. I don't always feel like I know the best thing to do. Wisdom's more than knowledge, isn't it? It's using good judgment. It's making sound decisions. It's being able to see past what might feel good right now in this moment to looking at the impact of it further down the road and for all people, more than just me. Most people who are wise gain their wisdom by experience, either firsthand or secondhand. But, you know, God can give us wisdom directly, sometimes without having to go through the school of hard knocks, the life experience. James says he gives us wisdom without reproach. He's not going to make you feel like you're stupid for needing to ask. He gives wisdom to those who ask it. So let's ask God for wisdom. So there's another place in the New Testament, in the Old Testament story itself, where we get a clue to the upper story. And that's Joseph's own perspective. We looked at this a little bit, but I want to go back and just look at it again, because Joseph had a great perspective looking back on his life. There's two places, Genesis chapter 45, verses 5 through 8. I'll read this, and then I'll read the one from Genesis 50. Okay, and now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. This is Joseph talking to his brothers. For God sent me before you to preserve life. But the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and the Lord of all his house and ruler over all the land. And then in Genesis 50, again, this is after Jacob dies, and he looks back on his life, and this is what he says. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, do not fear, but am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive, as they are today. So do not fear, I will provide for you and your little ones. Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. There's two things Joseph recognizes when he looks back. The first is God sent him. The brothers think they sent him to Egypt, and they intended it for his harm, to get rid of him. They intended it for evil, to make him suffer. And it did cause great suffering. It caused great suffering for Joseph. He was sold as a slave. He was separated from his family. It caused great suffering for Jacob. He had the grief of thinking he'd lost his favorite son. And even for the brothers, it caused suffering because they dealt with the guilt and the shame of that for years. They plotted evil and they sent him away. But God was in control, and he was able to take even a really bad thing, a sinful thing, and a very difficult thing. He was able to use it for good. They were going to kill him, but God worked the situation that he didn't get killed. He rescued him from that and ended up being a slave instead of being murdered. But God orchestrated every event. He determined where he would serve as a slave. He determined that he would be wrongly accused because, yeah, in the short term, that looked bad, but in the long term, that led to him being second command over the nation. And Joseph looks back, and he says, I can see now that you thought you sent me here for a really bad reason, but God sent me here. He's the one who sent me for good. It was ordered by God for his good purposes. And you know what? We're sent too. In John chapter 20, verse 21, Jesus says to them again, peace be with you. As the Father has sent me, so I am sending you. So God sends you and me to the world to represent him, to make him known. What a difference it would make in our lives if we walked about knowing we're sent. We're sent by God to make him known to the world. So let's be sent. Let's go and be a blessing, as we heard last week with Abraham and Sarah. wherever God sends us. Let's go and be. And then the other thing Joseph realizes as he looks back is God had purpose. Joseph saw that God had sent him to Egypt to keep the nation alive in the famine, to preserve them. And at the same time, he blessed Egypt and all the other nations around. Joseph could see that there was so much more than this, than his own personal hard luck story and all the difficulties that he went through. He saw that God was doing something so much bigger in protecting this family that would eventually become this nation, this special nation that God promised to build to be a blessing to the entire world. This wasn't a purpose he chose. It wasn't a purpose that he picked for himself, but he willingly accepted and saw God's hand in it. And actually, there was way more to God's purpose than even he knew. He didn't know how it would play out as the story of the nation unfolded, which we're going to see in the coming weeks. He didn't know anything of Moses or Joshua, the judges, David, the prophets, Jesus. He didn't know any of that. But isn't that true of our purpose too? Sometimes we do get a little bit of a glimpse of our role in God's story, just like Joseph got some glimpses. But I doubt whether any of us fully understands our purpose, and we probably won't this side of eternity. We may get a little bit of a sense, and we may not. But even if we do, even if we think we know what our purpose is, there's probably way more to it than we can't even see. And one day it'll be fun to find out, wasn't it? Oh, when that happened, that was part of, whoa, who knew? And when we can watch four generations down and see how something played out, won't that be awesome? I did that stupid thing, and you redeemed it with that. You are awesome, God, I love you. Or, wow, that thing I did, that was kind of good, wasn't it, God? That was, yeah, okay. Won't that be fun? Your life isn't meaningless. It has a purpose as part of God's story. So, Joseph's story gives us confidence that God's upper story, what he's doing in the big, grand, eternal scheme is unthwartable. And yes, I love that word. Craig loves fragrant. To him, it's totally frag. But to me, it's unthwartable. Unthwartable. God will build his nation. He will accomplish his purposes. And we're going to see that as we continue to see the story unfold. Yeah, God could have found an easier way to reconcile Joseph with his brothers. He could have freed Joseph from his captors at any point. He could have caused Joseph to be exonerated when he was falsely accused. He could have prevented the famine. But God had bigger plans, and Joseph was part of his story. Joseph didn't choose the course of his life. It wasn't easy. It wasn't fun, all the time at least. But when he looked back, he could certainly take pride in how his story had been part of God's story. Very few of us chart a course when we're young and just follow it to our graves, right? Most of our lives have unexpected twists and turns. I know ours has. Most of the things that we thought didn't turn out quite the way. It doesn't mean it was all bad, but it certainly wasn't all what we expected. Are we frustrated, disappointed, or do we trust that God has purpose in them? So what's happening in your lower story that causes you to question, is God really with me? Is God going to rescue me? Where's this favor? Where's the wisdom when I need it? Does my life have any meaning and purpose? I really believe that, I'm in trouble this morning. I really believe God wants us to be like Joseph. Whatever's going on in your lower story, whatever's going on in your day-to-day life, God's calling you like Joseph to be faithful and to trust him. And to trust that he is with you. His spirit is inside you. He's helping you. He's guiding you. To trust that he is rescuing you. Not always from your circumstances, but he is always in the business of rescuing you from sin and death into the certainty of eternal life with him. And to trust that you do have his favor. Expect it. Look for it. Celebrate his favor on your life when you recognize it and in the lives of those who you get to influence. And whose lives intersect with yours. Trust that he will give you wisdom that you need. Ask for it. Trust that God has sent you and is continuing to send you. We're his plan to represent him to a world in darkness. He sends each of us, whether you want to go there or not, he sends each of us to make him known and to trust that God does have a purpose for each of our lives, not necessarily for our obvious and immediate benefit and comfort, but each of us has a role in his upper story, his rescue mission to the world, to bring all those who are willing into a relationship with him. So let's trust God's sovereignty. Let's trust his presence with us, his favor, his wisdom, his plan. If the worship team wants to come back up, I'm going to pray. God, thank you. Thank you for your story. God, I'm so glad you wrote a story rather than a handbook. It's just so much richer to be able to read the story of how you interact with men, of how you go about your purposes. And God, it's far beyond us. We don't understand it all. But God, we do want to trust you this morning. We do want to trust you that we have a role in your story, that we matter to you, that we have purpose. We want to trust that you are with us, whether we feel it, whether we experience it every moment of the day or not, to trust that you are with us. We can always hold on to your presence in your lives, your spirit living inside of us. And God, I pray that these precious ones will be aware of your presence, and even when they aren't aware of your presence, will grow in trust of your presence in us, God. And God, we are just so grateful that we know that ultimately you will rescue us. And God, may that ultimate confidence just give us a trust that nothing that comes against us in this life can overpower us. There's nothing that can separate us from your love, God. There's nothing that can come in the way of that ultimate rescue of you in our lives. And whether or not you rescue us in our circumstances, God, give us the hope and the trust that you're in it all, God. Help us to believe that you have a plan. And God, we're so grateful that we have your favor. And God, I pray that you would give us eyes to see the places where we do have your favor, the places where we can be your influence to a world who so desperately needs to know you. Help us to recognize the places where you work in our lives and in ways that we could never imagine and could never orchestrate by ourselves, God. And Lord God, we need your wisdom. Help us remember to ask for it. Help us to remember that you've promised that you'll give us wisdom when we ask for it. God, we're asking. Give us wisdom. We don't know it all. We really need you. Just like Jacob needed you to interpret dreams, we need your wisdom for things in life that would otherwise be impossible for us, God. God, thank you that we have a place in your story. How awesome that you would choose to work in and through us towards your good purposes. God, we celebrate you. Thank you. We praise you. In Jesus' name, amen.